One thing you can count on pretty much all Americans to do, shopping. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, November 25th. I believe some people refer to it as Black Friday. Thanks for taking a break from all that shopping to be with us today. Also taking a few minutes off, Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville and John Carney of The Wall Street Journal. They're here for the weekly wrap. Hi, guys.
Hey, Molly.
Hi.
So let's talk about some of this shopping. There were new consumer confidence numbers out this week, showed a six-month high. Social chatter on Facebook is actually all about Black Friday. Do you think people, John, we'll start with you, are feeling more confident about their finances?
I think they very, very much are. In fact, it wasn't just a six-month high. There were some numbers we haven't seen for a decade. People think more people think that next year will be better for them financially than they have for the last 10 years.
Wow. Cardiff, what do you think that's about? Is that about the election being over, or is it actually about Trump?
It could be about the election being over, and it could be about the anticipation that Trump and the Republicans in Congress will do some things next year to spur the economy. Some of this is also, I think, just a cumulative effect. Remember that this is the first year in a while where we've seen fairly meaningful wage and income growth. People make a little bit more money. So, yeah, they feel a little bit better about spending it, too. So you combine that with maybe some relief that the campaign, the endless, interminable campaign, is finally over. And, yeah, it makes a certain amount of sense. And it's all in all quite a good thing.
And remember, after elections, the guy who won, represents a lot of people in America. So it's not that surprising that they're happy their guy won. So you expect a little boost.
Yeah, absolutely. Preliminary numbers are showing Thanksgiving shopping up so far. Let's stay on the commerce theme and the presidential theme and talk about appointments. What do we think about the speculation about Wilbur Ross, sometimes called the King of Bankruptcy, as the choice for Commerce Secretary?
Wilbur has a pretty good history of sounding Trumpian on things like trade deals. So I'm not that surprised. I think, Trump is trying to look outside of the normal, cast of characters in Washington, D.C. Wilbur Ross is certainly outside that cast of characters. He's kind of doing what he said he'd do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'd also just add that Commerce Secretary isn't all that meaningful a role. It can play a role in advising the president on what to do. It's in many ways kind of a showpiece job. So if Wilbur Ross wants a cushy little sinecure now, that's fine. I don't really care.
I like it. I like going nihilistic. That's just like, that's the way. All right. I know this is like kind of a downer, but I actually want to talk about tax policy that could eventually touch retail. This is from a story I saw in The Wall Street Journal, John, so I'm going to toss it to you. The proposed GOP tax changes floating around Congress that would overhaul tax policy, eliminate taxes on exports, impose them on imports. What would this mean?
Well, I first of all, this is all very preliminary, and anything you read now is unlikely to end up being the final policy. But it could mean a redistribution of the way income is divided in the U.S. It would help people who work in exporting manufacturing jobs in the U.S., and it would hurt people who work in industries that depend on a lot of imports. So the big technology companies that manufacture a lot outside of the U.S. may be hurt by some of this. And, sort of the more traditional, big guys in big rooms with big machinery manufacturing could be helped.
Yeah, I mean, we are definitely about to enter a period of very intricate horse trading. It's going to be very complicated. Lowering the tax rate in general and on its own is probably a belated idea. I think there's been a lot of bipartisan support for that in the past. But this particular way of doing it, combining it with a program that helps exporters and hurts importers, isn't necessarily the most efficient way of doing it. Really quickly, I'd add to my comment on Wilbur Ross earlier. The one thing that you can say, though, is that Trump is not exactly to this point stocking his cabinet with people that necessarily will appeal to the kind of voters that he appealed to during his campaign. He can't just appoint billionaires and multi, you know, people that make tens of millions of dollars. At some point, he's going to have to, I think, appoint people that can actually represent the same working class group that he said that he would try to benefit as president.
Although, Cardiff, I will say that they voted for the billionaires before.
True.
That's true. I'm going to stop you guys. I'm going to stop you guys there, but I will say that I knew Cardiff cared a little bit. Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville, John Carney of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot, guys.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks,
Happy
Molly.
Shopping.
Take care.
You too. And in fact, on Wall Street today, it would indeed seem that everyone is in a shopping kind of mood. We will have all the details when we do the numbers. Okay, a little more on shopping, because as I believe we've mentioned, Black Friday. Last year, at this time, retailers had just started to switch from swipe cards to chip-based credit cards. It was a hassle. This year, the chip readers are much more widespread, a little more established, but are they making our shopping more secure? Marketplace's Annie Baxter has a look.
Chip cards make it a lot harder for cyber criminals to steal your payment information from the physical point of sale, but
as it gets harder to perpetrate fraud in the stores, it's still easy to do it online.
Aviva Leighton is a cybersecurity expert at Gartner. She says cyber thieves can access your credit card number and the little CVV security code you find on the back because that's all stored in databases, which are hackable.
If you think about how many places you can pay your bill online, your utility bill, your insurance bill, that data is usually stored and it's sold in the black market.
Leighton says in Europe, where chip cards have existed for a long time, credit card fraud has largely migrated online. Experts predict the same thing will happen here. Oberther Technologies is one of the companies trying to address the problem. It manufactures a battery-powered chip card. Oberther's Martin Ferenzi says the security code on the back changes throughout the day.
That code changes every hour, allowing to provide a specific level of security for online transactions.
Ferenzi sent me a sample card to check out. Okay, the code on this right now is 439. An hour later, it had changed. Okay, the code is now 403. Those battery-powered cards are costlier, though, and some critics charge that card issuers are unwilling to spend extra to prevent online fraud. That's because they're not on the hook for the costs. The online merchants typically are. But Al Pasquale at Javelin Strategy and Research says the major card issuers have been developing some digital payment programs with added security.
A good example of what that may look like is MasterCard's identity check. That allows customers to prove their identity using either facial recognition, you know, everyone's called it selfie pay, or using a fingerprint scan.
But cyber thieves may figure out how to game the system no matter what, says cybersecurity expert Bruce Schneier.
Criminals are extraordinarily adaptive. They will adapt to whatever environment we give them.
Schneier adds consumers shouldn't fret about all this too much, though. He says check your statements for credit card fraud, but know that you're not the one liable for it. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Boy, General Motors and Ford are going to love those new tax rules we talked about a couple minutes ago. Both companies have announced plans to export trucks to China next year. China is not generally considered a market for big American rigs like the Chevy Silverado or my favorite, the Ford F-150. For one, strict emissions and size restrictions effectively ban trucks from most of China's big cities. But Chinese consumers want them, and the automakers want those global sales. Marketplace's Adam Ellington has more.
Chinese car buyers are already paying top dollar for U.S. trucks and SUVs, many of which are bought through back channels at U.S. dealerships and then shipped abroad. So GM and Ford can make money at this, but these cars aren't for everyone. For one, China slaps a 25% duty on all truck imports.
The upshot of which is an F-150 Raptor from Ford starts at about $80,000 after taxes and fees.
Michael Dunn is the author of American Wheels, Chinese Roads. He says GM tried to export trucks to China in the early 90s, but the vehicles were seen as overpriced and low class. That's no longer the case.
All of last year's growth and most of this year's growth in China is accounted for by SUVs and trucks. I really like the look and feel of trucks. Suddenly, that hasn't always been the case.
Dunn says trucks are a big hit among the newly affluent, of which there are many in China, and increasingly automakers are casting an eye toward global markets.
That's the name of the game, to make profits going forward.
Dave Andrea is with the Center for Automotive Research in Michigan. For the time being, he doesn't expect China to become a big market for trucks, but as domestic sales flatten, U.S. automakers could fill the gap by boosting global exports.
There will be niche markets around the world that will demand that type of truck, and the U.S. can export out of the U.S. to meet those niche needs.
Going forward, China has opened the door to pick up sales in four provinces, but it remains to be seen whether the major cities along the coast will follow suit. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Now that the shopping season is finally upon us, it's time to check in on seasonal employment. Big retailers, as usual, are looking for workers, but the problem is a lot of people already have jobs. Unemployment has hovered near 5% all year. But with companies competing for seasonal workers, the holidays could be an opportunity for those who are still underemployed. Marketplace's Mariel Segura reports.
23-year-old Rahim Anthon was laid off from his job at a mobile phone company in October. He's been applying for seasonal work ever since.
Right now, I'm unemployed. I have a couple of job applications that have already been sent out.
Overall, unemployment is low. William Spriggs is chief economist at the labor organization, AFL-CIO.
There are not as many people looking for work as there are job openings.
That tight labor market might actually work in favor of groups that have stubbornly high unemployment rates, including African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and young people.
It means that employers suddenly look up and see some qualified workers that they have been ignoring.
Even if low unemployment does help people find jobs this holiday season, seasonal jobs are still seasonal. Carrie Gleason is with the Workers Advocacy Group, the Center for Popular Democracy.
Companies do mass layoffs in January when the holiday season is over.
But in this labor market, at least some of those jobs will become permanent. And that's good tidings for workers in general. In New York, I'm Mariel Segura for Marketplace.
There is a certain kind of birthday experience that was a staple of childhood for lots of people. That experience, it's not a pony. The experience is funfetti, rainbow sprinkles, jimmies. Whatever you call them, funfetti is back, and it is bigger than ever. And it's making everything from cakes to martinis a whole lot more colorful and fun. If you don't believe me, you can just ask Instagram. Or ask Julia Moskin, a food reporter for the New York Times. She recently wrote an article titled The Funfetti Explosion. Julia, how are you?
Great, thanks.
So let's start with the beginning. What exactly, for those who don't know, is funfetti?
Well, funfetti seems to be a synonym, virtually, for rainbow sprinkles. It is something that I was not familiar with until I went to a very sort of fancy farm-to-table restaurant in Brooklyn. And the cheese course was this beautiful slab of very expensive gorgonzola cheese covered with rainbow sprinkles, like crusted with rainbow sprinkles. And I thought, this is a very strange thing. So I started Googling rainbow sprinkles. And when you Google rainbow sprinkles, you come very quickly to funfetti.
Right. So it's sort of the branded version of rainbow sprinkles?
So funfetti is actually a brand name belonging to Pillsbury. It was introduced in 1988 as frosting first. And then somehow some genius had the idea of putting the sprinkles that came with the frosting in the frosting and then putting the sprinkles that came with a cake mix in the cake. And right. Obviously, since this was introduced in 1989, the kids who were growing up in the 90s were apparently completely obsessed with funfetti cake. One of the bloggers I spoke to, Molly Ye, who has spent hours and weeks developing a sort of homemade version, said that it was as if chocolate and vanilla suddenly ceased to exist.
Well, I can tell you that my adult brother, who is a little younger than I am, still insists on a funfetti cake for his birthday with no frosting, just the cake. But so there's an element of nostalgia to a sprinkles craze that seems to be resurging, right? What, is there a funfetti comeback?
There's a huge funfetti comeback, mostly because of social media. And, you know, for sort of complicated nostalgic reasons, because of the overwhelming numbers of millennials, who I hope that they are going to start calling themselves funfettials, or the funfetti generation. So that is what has made Funfetti so popular. You can see so many images on sharing sites like Pinterest, like Instagram, partly just because, of course, rainbow sprinkles are very photogenic. And many things in the ordinary baking world, like sugar cookies or pound cake, possibly they don't look as interesting as people would wish when the main goal of making them is posting them.
So are you finding, let's talk money here, are you finding that a lot of businesses are capitalizing on this trend? Is it sort of more small artisanal creations?
Well, you have a place, let's say in New York, like the Big Gay Ice Cream Company. Now, they really kind of make an investment in their sprinkles. They custom mix their own blend. They're very careful about the colors. But the fact is that sprinkles are a very cheap commodity product. It's a very cheap way to add this kind of millennial flair and color to your product.
Now, you made, according to your article, a homemade Funfetti cake of your own for due diligence. How did you do it and how did it turn out?
Well, it's easy. I mean, it's really just a white cake mix. I made a very ordinary golden cake, perhaps with one fewer egg yolks than usual. I cannot tell you how beautiful those artificial sprinkles are in the cake.
I have to say, all of this is really giving me a lot more affection for the Funfetti generation. Julia Muskin is a reporter for the food section at the New York Times. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Molly.
Coming up,
she made it so much easier to both grow and weave cotton that Songjiang became the cotton manufacturing capital of the world at that time.
One trailblazing woman who changed history a long, long, long time ago. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 68 points, a 3%, to end at 19,152. The NASDAQ gained 18 points, a 3%. To finish at 5398, the S&P 500 was up 8 points, 0.4% to close at 2213. For the week, the Dow rose 1.5%. The Nasdaq also advanced 1.5%, and the S&P 500 moved up 1.4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.35%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker.
If we want to survive, we need to change our bodies.
I never in my wildest dreams when I was teaching her how to do this thought that she would actually have to do it.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Italians go to the polls on December 4th in a referendum which could decide the future of Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. They're voting on a proposed change to the Constitution, which would make it easier for the government to push through legislation. That includes the power to reform the country's troubled banking sector, which is currently suffering from a huge buildup of bad loans. The crisis has taken down dozens of local banks, it is threatening national institutions, and it's ruining lives across the country. The BBC's Tony Bonsignore reports from Italy.
Allora siamo io ho visto dei cambiamenti verso maggio di mio marito.
Laura Schiavo pauses as she remembers the family's final day together. It was the summer of 2014, and the 41-year-old from Padua had shared a meal with her husband Dario and their three children. Dario had been acting distant and troubled for months, she remembers, and she was worried for his health.
On Wednesday, the 11th of June, he said goodbye to us all with a smile, something he hadn't done for a while. He had breakfast with us, said goodbye, and that was the last time we saw him.
2 days later, Dario's body was found. He'd committed suicide, aged just 40. In a note, he blamed a barrage of calls from a debt agency working on behalf of the bank from whom the couple borrowed €20,000 just under a year before. They took out the loan to fulfil their dream of starting their own business selling e-cigarettes. Laura's debt remains on the books of the bank that lent them the money. All over Italy, there are thousands of similar stories of small firms taking out loans they've since struggled to repay. In financial jargon, they're called non-performing loans, or NPLs. And according to one recent estimate, Italian banks have around 360 billion euros worth of NPLs on their books. And it's becoming a huge problem for savers, for the government, and for financial markets.
It's the middle finger that represents the opinion of Italian savers with respect to Italian banks today. You know, I typically have...
Professor Carlo Alberto Maffei meets me outside the Milan Stock Exchange, next to the now famous and controversial statue of a giant extended middle finger. He says that what was once a strength of the Italian banking system is now a massive problem, made worse by the state of Italy's economy and new EU rules which force bank savers to take a hit when a bank gets into trouble.
Most of the Italian debt problem for banks is due to the fact that lending has been inspired not to rational analysis of risk. It is an arbitrary process based on local links and relationships. We call it territorial banking because we have so many banks so close to firms and companies.
A key part of the problem is that no one can quite decide how much these NPLs are worth. A short stroll from the Italian Stock Exchange and Maurizio Cattelan's middle finger are the elegant offices of financial advisors Fidentiis. In his office, overlooking Milan's towering Duomo Cathedral, Managing Director Gianluca Codagnoni says too few local bankers thought to centralise their paperwork on computers.
When you look at the small, medium-sized bank, this process of digitalising every piece of info was not progressed enough. Because simply these banks were not contemplating a possible sale of the NPL.
Give us an indication of the physical scale of the challenge they've got then.
It can be massive. One day I had the chance of looking into a 800 million euro portfolio of non-performing loans, and we calculated that we needed 3 million hours to look at all the documents because they were all paper.
It's a problem with no easy solution. Italian banks can't afford to write down these loans to their current market value. Under new EU rules, the Italian government can't bail out the banks without making savers pay as well. And all the time, small family businesses, the lifeblood of Italy's economy, are struggling to get the funding they desperately need.
That was Tony Ponzignore from the BBC. So we're doing an occasional series this winter, stories about women featured in the book Wonder Women, 25 innovators, inventors, and trailblazers who changed history. It's by Sam Meggs. So far, we talked about a doctor who was inspired by Jurassic Park, sisters who fought to become doctors in the 19th century, and today we're going really far back in time.
Huang Daopo was born into a small village outside of Shanghai called Songjiang in about 1240 or 1245, so a super long time ago. Huang was sold at a very early age to another family as a child bride, was mistreated, had a pretty terrible life. She ran away to an island just off the mainland of China that had their own culture, their own language. While she was there on this island, she learned a whole new style of weaving and was able, at about 50 years old, to get on a boat, come back to Songjiang, bring a new type of cotton seed that was more easily able to be grown, and brought back this new weaving style. And between the two of those things, she made it so much easier to both grow and weave cotton that Songjiang became the cotton manufacturing capital of the world at that time and made it incredibly prosperous. Huang Daopo basically invented things that we wouldn't see in the Western world until the 1700s with the invention of the cotton ginny and the spinning jenny. So pretty cool.
That was Sam Meggs, the author of the book Wonder Women. The this final note before we go, let's check in on the holiday shopping as it stands so far. Notable headlines, more and more retailers staying closed on Thanksgiving, but you cannot stop the internet. Adobe Digital Insight says online sales were up 11.5% on Turkey Day. That's less than analysts expected, but apparently that's because people went bananas shopping online on Wednesday night. Early winners there were Target and Kohl's. As for Black Friday so far, the Macy's website has already collapsed under the pressure. Williams-Sonoma had a slowdown. But one analytics firm put out a chart comparing online retailers, and it's clear that Amazon is going to clean up as usual. Other notable Black Friday promotions, the Trump Store. The president-elect's online shop is offering Black Friday discounts of up to 30% on merchandise like t-shirts, tree ornaments, and of course, the hats. Political analysts tell Bloomberg that a campaign-related Black Friday sale is probably a first in politics. And that is our show for this Thanksgiving week. Today, the Dow rose 68 points, the NASDAQ was up 18, and the S&P 500 was up 8 points, about 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fergali. Sitara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I am Molly Wood. Have a great weekend. Kai Rizdahl will be back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.